Welcome back, everyone. This is Dr. Daisy Gonzalez, Interim Chancellor for California's Community Colleges, and you're listening to another episode of the California Community Colleges Chancellor's Office podcast. Thank you for joining me today. If you're returning to our podcast, then you already know that the 22-23 series has featured California Community College alumni reflecting on their educational journey and their impact on our state. By dedicating this podcast series to alumni in our system, my hope is that we can create a space to uplift alumni, their lived experiences, and the impact of California's community colleges through the hard work and dedication of extraordinary human beings. May is both National Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month and Mental Health Awareness Month. California is the most populous and culturally diverse state in the country. It is home to more than 6 million Californians from AAPI descent, an estimated 16.4% of the state's total population. This community includes a wide range of ethnicities, cultures, customs, and languages. And according to Mental Health America, AAPI adults are the racial group least likely to seek mental health services, 3 times less likely than their white counterparts. So as we celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, an annual celebration that pays tribute to the generations of AAPIs who have enriched America's history, it is also important to focus on the mental health of AAPIs. This podcast episode will feature Dr. Nellie Tran, a California Community College alum, a community psychologist, someone who will share her educational journey, but more importantly, will also help us address student mental health as a part of our collective goal to achieve equity and access and equity and success for our students. Welcome, Dr. Tran. How are you feeling today?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here to talk about community colleges.
Well, I'm so honored to have you here as our guest. And before we get started, I want to make sure that our listeners know a little bit about you. You have an extensive expertise in this topic, in this community, and your legacy, the one that you are building today, is impacting millions of Californians. So I want to share a little bit about that. Dr. Nellie Tran is a published Vietnamese American, San Diego State University professor, research scientist, and higher education advocate who is passionate about empowering students, specifically underserved student populations, students of color, to pursue their higher education. Dr. Tran attended Mesa College and Miramar College before transferring to UCLA to complete her BA in psychology. From there, she attended the University of Illinois Chicago, where she earned her PhD in psychology. Dr. Tran is a past president of the Asian American Psychological Association. As an educator in the classroom, she facilitates students' critical awareness of social injustice, inequity, and privilege to teach her students to be critical consumers of research and information. Her students learn to bridge critical thinking to their lived experiences in order to build critical awareness of themselves and the world that they live in and work in, which enables her students to expand their perspective and context, and in return, become multiculturally competent counselors and psychologists. Thank you for your work, Dr. Tran, and for spending time with me today.
Thank you for having me.
So as you heard me say, and as you know very well, May is a time of year where we celebrate and illuminate the contributions of AAPI individuals and leaders. And I want to start off by asking you about your heritage. What makes you especially proud of your heritage? And who do you look up to for inspiration within your community?
Oh, I love this question, especially for this month. So I am the daughter of Vietnamese refugee boat people. So my heritage is from Vietnam, where my family's ancestral lands are. And we came to the U.S. in search of a better life. My dad, my mom came here when my mom was still pregnant with me. And so I feel like I'm most proud of the fact that we are a peoples who have survived war, migration, colonization, and that there is strength in our history and our legacy. And we have a very strong desire to stay in community and in family. And so I think that I take great pride in the fact that despite all the disruption to our culture and to our people and communities, we have a strong sense of family still. And that my family has, over the generations, been able to maintain our bloodlines and to be able to maintain our cultural heritage no matter which lands we currently live in. So I am most proud of that strength of my Vietnamese people to have survived and maintained our culture through generations of war and colonization and now migration to the US as well. I was thinking a lot about who I feel inspired by, and the person who came to mind for me was Thich Nhat Hanh. And he's, you know, known as a Buddhist monk who brought the idea of mindfulness to our world. But I actually feel inspired by him because as a Vietnamese Buddhist monk during the Vietnam War, he was the person who was actually hated by both the North and the South and by the US because he was preaching for peace. And he was advocating for people who were most disenfranchised, people with the least amount of power. He saw that war did nothing more than hurt disenfranchised people. And so he advocated for peace and for nonviolence around the world. And his ideas around mindfulness was to help people see humanity in one another so that they would not hurt each other. And he has pushed for the unification of the Vietnamese people globally. And I think we forget that. And I'm really reminded when I think about him, I'm very reminded that it's not about power, it's about people. And so if we think deeply, if we are mindful, if we really are thinking about humanity, then we will think about what it's like to be unified, to be in unity, to be together, to fight against structures of power that disenfranchise people. And I really take that to heart in my work today and bringing people together to see that, you know, we have more in common than we have different from one another, and we are more powerful together than we are apart.
Thank you for sharing that. I'm so honored to share this space, and I can already see where that inspiration comes from, but also how you inspire others in that way. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So I've read your bio, and I've got to say, I'm very impressed with everything that you have done, with the legacy that you are creating, and the way that you are empowering your students and other Californians here. And I know that the last few years have been difficult. So this next question is inspired by that, inspired by our students. You know, every time I head out into the field, I hear students say, but I could never get there. Or how do you grow up in foster care and end up state chancellor? And I think as people are listening to these stories, but particularly you, Dr. Tran, I want to ask you this question and really hoping that they are able to hear your journey. Tell us a little bit about the start of this journey. What was your experience like at a California community college?
Oh, thank you for asking this. I feel myself blushing when you talk about my achievements in this way. I don't see myself that way. And I feel like when I was reflecting on where I began, I felt like it was, I feel as though it's really important for people to know that I was very unimpressive. I think I was not, I think I've wanted to do great things. I felt a sense of urgency and need to do something good in the world, but I don't feel as though I was very impressive on paper. You know, I failed second grade. I tried to do the smart things, but I think I was feeling as though I was always pretending to be smart rather than feeling really smart. My parents used to say that, you know, between my little brother and I was the one that worked hard. I wasn't the smart one. He's the smart one. I'm the one that works hard. So, you know, I didn't get into the colleges of my choice. I thought I had done well in high school. It turns out I didn't do well enough, you know, and I was really disappointed. And so I decided to go to community college because I thought that rather than settling and, you know, just going to any college, I thought I would take time to figure out who I was by going to community college and staying home and saving some money. And so I just went to school. I feel like I was just going to school and letting community college be a stepping stone for me. And so it turns out upon reflection that it was the perfect choice for me because the classroom structure is smaller. It was a smaller community. It felt a little bit more like high school. Once I transferred, I realized that it's a lot harder to be a student in a class of, you know, 100 to 300 students. The community colleges gave me a smaller classroom. It was an easier way for me to figure out how to do independent work and, you know, maintain my own schedule and figure out how to enroll in classes and figure out who I was going to be. It also allowed me to fail a lot. Like I said, I wasn't a great, perfect student. I wanted at the time to be a pre-med major, you know, like many other Asian Americans, and I couldn't pass my, you know, my hard science classes. I couldn't pass my calculus classes, and I'm fairly certain I took calculus at least 5 times, maybe more, in order to pass the class. But it allowed me that freedom to do that over and over again while I figured out how to learn in this new way, how to, you know, whether or not I wanted to pursue the majors that I was interested in. And so when I transferred to UCLA, all of those mistakes were wiped away. And so I got to start fresh, and I found psychology at the community colleges. I took my first psych classes. I took 2 psychology classes, and they were also my only 2 Asian American female professors that I ever have had. And they came to me as my first psych teachers at Mesa College. And so they showed me the love of psychology, and I fell for it, you know, and then I knew I had to go to UCLA, and it set me on a path that I would not have otherwise been on had I gone straight to a 4-year institution. So I think it was a great place for where I was in my life. I didn't know that I needed that kind of soft place to land when I was rejected so much, you know, in high school. So that was me. I think it was unimpressive. I think I tried new things. I think I also had some really bad professors at community college, and I kind of figured out, you know, what I needed from a teacher and, you know, what worked for me, what didn't, and, you know, where I needed to suck it up and do what I needed to do. So I learned all these things. I grew into college nice and slow, and I saved a lot of money. I was able to work part-time, and my family was able to kind of come into what it would cost to go to college. And so when I went to UCLA, we had the money for me to be able to live in the dorms while I was there in my first year.
Wow. I'm in awe because I'm having that aha moment podcast after podcast over the last year of hearing major themes of community colleges as the space where people find what they love, right? Mm-hmm. So you fell in love with psychology. I also heard from many of the other guests that we've had that they found that faculty member that they identified with, largely because we have a very diverse student population. And they found belonging, right? It were in spaces where maybe they couldn't quite find it, and class size was very important to them. I'm happy to share with you, too, that we've been making a lot of improvements. California's community colleges now offer baccalaureate degrees, so you don't have to transfer. And you mentioned that you had taken the class over and over again. We've done a lot of changes in that area as we think about better supports, co-requisites, tutoring for students, additional supports as our students are going through their courses. But thank you for sharing that journey. I heard a little bit about then what inspired you to go into teaching, and I know that you're a faculty member. Mm-hmm. So this next question is about how your community college experience at California's community colleges impacted your career choices.
Well, I discovered psychology. I discovered that Asian American women can be professors in psychology. So those were really important, I think, firsts that I had. But I had both good and bad teachers while I was at community college. You know, I remember writing essays and having teachers pull me aside and talk to me about my thinking about different topics of the time, you know, and I had never had a teacher care. And I remember going, oh, I just picked the side of this issue because I thought it would be easier to write. And they were, you know, they would tell me, well, no, but what do you think? You know, right? And I thought, oh, what do you mean? What do I think? I think you pick a side of an issue and you write about it, you know? Like, I think it was like the start of people having enough time to guide me just enough. But I also had teachers, I think, who underestimated me. And I remember one teacher I had would tell us that we were no good and that we were not going to make anything of ourselves. And
that we may never transfer, that there would be a very small percentage of us who would ever go on to do anything with our life. And I remember thinking, like, you don't know me. You don't know why I'm here. And I just felt so offended. And I remember going to the dean's office and, you know, wanting to report him and, you know, kind of coming into my power a little bit and realizing that, like, whoa, he went too far, you know? And it was interesting because I saw the range, right, at community college. And so I saw that I could have some power. This was a small enough kind of college campus that my voice could make a difference. I also learned that professors have a lot of power, you know, power to create change, power to, you know, allow students to chase a dream, but also power to hold them back. And I really saw, I remember thinking this one professor that he must have led a life where, you know, he's got some things holding him back and he's not taking it out on us. And I think a lot about that when I work with my counseling students now, that they too have probably been injured and traumatized in their own upbringing. And that if we don't work through that, if we don't heal from that, then we will only endanger other people. So I think a lot about that. And I feel like I want to be a part of helping people to see that so that they can go on to be in service of others. And I think all of that kind of early thinking came from community college. It was a slow enough environment for me that I could actually think for myself. That wasn't the case once I got to UCLA. I felt like it was so fast paced. I was just on a track. I wasn't able to really think and cultivate my thinking in important ways.
So you became a leader and a scholar, and that's really powerful for a first-generation college student. And I'm glad that you were able to make the connections. I know that doesn't happen for some students, and mental health is a really big part of that, but also your support networks, right?
Yeah.
I'm wondering, you know, your background is in working with students, not just in the classroom, but also in making sure that mental health is a top priority for Californians. So I want to segue into that direction because mental health is a crisis. It is one of the biggest growing needs for California's community colleges, and not just for our students, but I think coming out of this pandemic, right?
Mm-hmm.
I know when we did a statewide survey of formerly enrolled students, we asked, what would it take for you to come back to our colleges? And mental health was one of those needs, along with childcare, which I think there's a connection there.
Yes.
That we can explore. But as we emerge from this pandemic, you are an expert. I'm wondering, what do you see are those critical mental health issues that are impacting our students, and what can we do about it?
There were so many issues before COVID. Mental health was not an important feature. Many colleges had already been working to increase the amount of mental health services on campus and increasing visibility and outreach to students. So I think it's important for us to remember that the crisis we're in now began long before COVID. COVID was just a catalyst that made things unbearable. And I think we are at a breaking point now. I know that these last couple of years has been really hard for everyone. And I think students are at a disadvantage right now because they are in a developmental stage, right? They're supposed to be learning and transitioning. There's a lot of transition already kind of baked into the process, right? They're going from high school to college. They're young adults who are learning to be independent for the first time in their life. And they've got all of these hardships that are happening, these transitions. But on top of that, I think as a collective, we have not created enough space for us as a country to transition, right? Not just as a country, but as a world, to transition from a world where COVID was a killer to one where we are going to have to live with it. And, you know, if you think about in our country, we lost over 1.1 million people due to COVID.
Yeah.
We know that these are typically underreports, right? And that across the globe that confirmed we have almost 7 million people who died. That's a lot of grief that has gone unprocessed. And, you know, we talk a lot about the employment sector and how we don't have a strong enough workforce. And I keep wondering, well, these people who have passed must have held some of these positions. It's not just because people don't want to go back to work. It's also because we've literally lost such a sizable number of our population. And many of our students, I think, especially underserved students, come from families where they have lost many people, you know, that their extended networks are larger and many of their family members worked in very vulnerable positions during COVID. And some of the people I know have lost 6-7 people during COVID. And you can't just get over that. There's these transitions, there's a lot of grief, and there's a mourning of the loss of people, the loss of, I think, human developmental stages that a lot of our students should have been going through. I think they didn't get a chance to go through those stages of development. And now we need time to recover. How can we help people to come back into their social support networks and have tolerance for difficult things in life, mourn the loss of what has, but continue to move forward and grow, ask for help, learn how to do things again, and not just kind of ask to get by? And I think that's a hard reality to start to accept, that we might be ready for that.
Thank you for sharing that with us. I know in the last 2 fiscal years, the state has heavily invested in mental health, unlike, you know, prior decades. But now even more important than ever, the nurturing, the healing, I think the resetting, as you mentioned, of what it will take to continue to thrive when everything changed, right? We think of all of the sectors that completely shut down that will never return to be the same, right? I'm talking about our day-to-day, right?
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that. You know, as you were talking, I was reflecting on all the people that I've lost in my life. So also just thinking about those that are listening and saying, you know, I think we all have a lot more in common, as Dr. Tran shared earlier, than we think. And I think this pandemic teaches us that. As I think about the future, I know that is what our students need to hear as well.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's also worth remembering that it wasn't just a COVID pandemic that happened. We also had a large racial reckoning that happened in this country simultaneously. So there was a lot of stress, you know, there was a lot of emotional turmoil that was happening across our country. And now when you add in war and large, you know, crisis migrations, there's just a lot going on still, you know, and that takes a toll on people emotionally. And we need to start learning how to be together in some of that pain, I think.
I love that. You know, that's a great transition. I was actually going to ask you about that because our colleges have been developing spaces where students feel like they are safe, that they belong. There's a lot more work there to be done, especially as we all come back into brick and mortar education, begin to see each other more in person. But we saw during the pandemic an increase in hate and violence against AAPI communities. We also know that this was not new as well, and that there are really harmful stereotypes that impact our AAPI students. I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about that. How does that impact our AAPI student mental health? And then when they come into our classrooms, right? When we seek to empower them with education.
Yeah, I think one thing that's important to remember is that there was a rise in visibility, right, of anti-Asian hate. It wasn't that it didn't exist prior to kind of the COVID beginnings when we started to see it. So there's this new thing that happened where we saw it in the media and there was more conversation about it. There's more conversation about it now than there has been in my lifetime. But many of us who have been on the forefront of talking about it have been kind of begging for the visibility for a long time. And I think that really reinforces these images, these stereotypes that we have about Asian Americans. So, you know, within kind of the Asian American studies, we often talk about the model minority stereotype, right? That Asian Americans are seen as an ethnic or racial group that does so well, despite the fact that they are experiencing racism in the US. And that kind of came about during the civil rights movement as a way of saying that racism doesn't impact all of people so long as you work hard. But the problem is that stereotype started in the 60s as a way of pitting Asian Americans against African Americans in the US to say that the civil rights movement was not appropriate. And what we know now is that those images were created with East Asians in mind. And the Asian American diaspora is actually very diverse. You know, there are over 20 different ethnic groups that are represented in sizable numbers in the US, all of whom have their own language, culture, and heritage. And so in the US, when we talk about Asian Americans, we're talking about, you know, the largest continent on earth, and a lot of groups that have their own kind of intergroup dynamics as well. And that when Asians are seen as high achieving or that they are doing so well, then they don't get included in the conversation about resources or needs, right? People then forget that there are Asian Americans who aren't doing well, that there are Asian American ethnic groups that have the lowest income levels across any ethnic group in the US, that the diaspora, the Asian American category, is one of the most diverse racial groups in the country. And so we can't just think about those who are doing well. We have to think about, why aren't all Asians doing well? And it's so convenient, I think, for people to not think about Asian Americans because they're doing well, but then in their next breath also think about Asians as perpetual foreigners, right? So that at the start of COVID, the anti-Asian hate that we saw was very much linked to seeing Asians as foreigners, as people who are never going to be American. And that really, you know, goes together with the model minority stereotype that no matter how well you do in America and how many generations you've been here, you still will never be seen as American enough. And that model then going into the classroom means that a lot of Asian Americans have spent their whole lives trying to be as American as they possibly can be and not being able to think about who they are, what they want to be when they grow up, and how they want to contribute to this country, but rather are just trying to belong, right? And I think that that can be really dangerous because we need people to know who they are. We need them to interrogate how they've gotten to where they are and who they want to be in the future and how they want to kind of be their most authentic self, because that will be what keeps you most healthy and happy and contributing members of society. It's also the case that, you know, if Asian Americans remain invisible and unknown, then they stay very easy targets for xenophobia and someone to be feared whenever things don't go well in the US. And I think we see a lot of that happening as well.
Thank you for sharing that. You know, I think we saw a little bit of that generalization as we looked at our statewide data pre-pandemic, our AAPI students as a cohort, right? When you combine all the different ethnic groups, you know, all of the diversity really around our AAPI students, we saw that our students were doing well as a cohort. And then during the pandemic, we saw that number go down. And when you further disaggregate, you're right. There were a lot of Filipino students that left our system. Mm-hmm. And then you start looking at the interconnection between poverty, then regions of the state, right? What happens to San Francisco is very different from what happens in like the Central Coast, right?
Yes.
And the access that there is to resources in those communities. So thank you for highlighting that. I'm wondering then if you could say a little bit more about, if we know that this is the case and it impacts our students, what is then our message to those educators in the classroom? What would you share? You are an educator yourself. What would you share about what is important to better serve our AAPI students?
Well, I think it's important to remember that, you know, access to information is such an important starting point. And if our students don't have access to information, or our potential students don't have access to information, then they can't come into our classrooms. So are we out there, you know, do you have materials that are in language for people to learn about programs? Are your classes accessible? You know, if we really want to be inclusive, are we speaking in plain enough English that every student has access to the knowledge that we are trying to impart? You know, so many of us speak in metaphors and colloquialisms that we forget that those are learned, you know, kind of slang from the English language. And that is very difficult for people who come from different cultures, right? I've had so many professors who are really sarcastic. And sarcasm, again, is very difficult to understand if you are new to the English language, right? So I think it's about making sure that we as people, as educators, are accessible, that we are, you know, representing as much of our students as we can in the way that we teach. you know, I think I learned about community college because my dad went to community college. So he made it easier for me to be able to accept that, you know, community college was a good stepping stone for me. And I think the more that we see ourselves in the student body and see what, you know, community college can do for us, then the more people will be willing to learn about it and give it a chance. I also think kind of culturally, it's important for educators to remember that, you know, many of the Asian cultures and other cultures as well, but for sure, Asian cultures teach respect for elders, and teachers and education often are revered as very wise people. And so they have a lot of power. They have a lot of power over students. Whether they want it or not is not even a question. They have it. And so they have the power to both do good for students and then empower students, to inspire students, but they also have a lot of power to harm students, right? And so I hope that educators know that when they speak to students, that their words will linger with students and to do good with that, and that students have competing demands, right? Because family and community are really important to students, that sometimes school ends up being a back burner and that family is something that is most important. I think that it's not because they don't care. It's just because there's a lot going on. And so to care for our students as humans, right, that have a lot going on, and not to hold it against them as humans just because they can't complete a class, you know?
I love that. So flexibility is not a choice, but a necessity, really.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that. And please thank your dad for showing you the way to community colleges. I also want to make sure that I acknowledge your comment about information. You know, that was a big inspiration during this pandemic for us to redo our website and really think through with new state resources on how we better engage students to create one single stop where Californians can get all information that they need, whether it's career exploration, as you mentioned, where you're just trying to figure out what it is that you want to do, to how you transfer to a UC or a CSU or a four-year institution, to what kind of financial aid is out there. And I know I'm really happy to share that not only do we have a single website, but you can also find all information about new resources. Our colleges now have food pantries, and you can go there and bring your entire family. And then with new state investments, our colleges also offer mental health resources. And so that website is called icangotocollege.com. And honoring this month, we launched a new language version. So we already had it in English, in Spanish, in Chinese, in Vietnamese. This May, we are opening it up in Korean. And none of these language options existed before. And I think that's something beautiful that came out of the pandemic innovation.
That's so wonderful to hear.
Dr. Chan, I know I heard you talk a lot about faculty. You're a faculty member, but I love asking this question as we head towards the end of our podcast. Can you name one person from your California Community College experience that you want to thank publicly and tell us why?
I'm going to name two because I can't.
That's very common, by the way.
But I would love to thank Dr. Dina Miyoshi and Dr. Jay Van Kirk. They are the two Asian women psychology professors that I took classes with. And I think about them all the time. I know they still teach there. They are the people who showed me that psychology was cool. And they showed me that I could be a professor of psychology, and they made it possible. They really showed me that that path existed. And I am so grateful that I landed in their class and that they were the women who inspired me. And I owe a great deal to having been in their classes 20 plus years ago.
Thank you for sharing that. We honor them today and every day. And thank you. I can't wait to send them this podcast with a special note.
Oh, yes.
Thank you. You know, the other question that I added to finish up our podcast was a request of students after a few episodes. They wanted to know from our alums. So this is for you, Dr. Tran. Mm-hmm. Every student journey is unique, so we know that. But what are your words of advice or encouragement to that community college student, but maybe in particular our AAPI students who may be listening to you right now?
I thought a lot about this. I feel like, you know, if you're coming up through the system, I hope that you'll take a moment and find a goal that makes sense for you and chase it. And then ask how every teacher and school that you land in, how can they help you to get that goal? And ask them specifically, what do you need to do to make that happen, right? Knowing that you may not have the skills that you need to have right now to pass the classes you need, but what are the skills and what are the classes, what are the things that you need to know, right? Make them hold high expectations of you and know that you can meet them, but make them help you get there, right? Like make them be a part of your journey, right? The timing might not be right. There may be a lot going on in your life and that's okay. It doesn't need to be right now, but where there's a will, there has to be a way and you have to stay committed to the process, right? And know that if you just keep sticking to the process and that you will be real about what you're capable of and that you will bring people onto the journey with you, that you will get there. It'll just take time, right? But one step at a time, and don't let people lowball you when it comes to skills and knowledge. You deserve all the skills and all the knowledge. You don't need them to lower the bar for you. You're deserving of knowing the knowledge that they have and the skills that they are teaching other people. So, and don't lowball yourself. Like you're capable of this. It just might take a different timeline or a different period of your life, but you're capable of doing it. So find the people who want to support you in that process and, you know, you'll get there.
Oh, that's very powerful, Dr. Tran. Well, this is the end of our podcast. I want to thank you, Dr. Tran. What a meaningful way to honor Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month. And thank you for sharing your expertise in the area of mental health.
Thank you so much for having me.
I hope that you enjoyed learning about Dr. Tran and her journey. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of the California Community Colleges Chancellor's Office podcast.
Be sure to join us for the next California Community Colleges podcast. This has been a California Community Colleges presentation. Mm-hmm.